This is Foos Week, folks. Your one-stop positivity shop for all things foosball. This is where we talk about the week behind and the week ahead. The week behind, we just had the Illinois State Foosball Championships. Our guest was there that weekend. We'll be getting to him very soon here. That's Ken Dale. But before we do that, I want to know how Hannah Smith is doing. How you doing, Hannah?
Hey. Well, actually, I'm doing fabulous.
Good.
So, cool weekend, and I'm on my way to winning a bet with my buddy Maddie for we're talking noise about a high school baseball game, like playoff games, like so the series. So we bet some money on it, and we were just finishing up watching the game, and my team won 10-0 in the first game. So I'm a happy girl so far. So I really can't complain.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, what are you betting? Like, you don't have to, is it like gold bullion? Is it, tens of thousands of dollars? What's on the line here?
Yeah, yeah. Ooh. It's a pretty big deal. Like, after we won, I was like, I got to go have a Red Bull to celebrate. So here I am. They're called Green Bulls here. They're not Red Bulls. He's like, we got to go get one of them Green Bulls. I'm like, all right, buddy, we'll get one. Let's do it.
That is not money. That is not my metric for big money, but I get that. Okay, that's good.
Can I interject with, please? That's so money. That's so money.
Oh, I love it, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
That is topical AF. And Tom, how are you doing, sir?
You know, it's another great day here in upstate New York. It always is a great day in upstate New York if the sun comes out at all. So, yeah, there you have that. By the way, Adam, man, have you been rehearsing that intro now? Have you been, like, working on that?
Like, this is Foos Week. Yes, I do it all the time.
Awesome, man.
I was talking to my wife the other day, and I was like, what sounds better? This is Foos Week, or this is Foos Week? And she's like, you're an idiot. She didn't actually say that. She's very supportive, but she gave me that look. You know, I
love
fine.
It, man. You are a student of the master of ceremonies, man. You're doing it. You're killing this thing.
Sure. Feels good. I haven't gotten to the point where I record myself and listen to it again, though.
Okay. All right. Well, that'll happen.
Yeah. Well, so Tom, when you say the weather's good there in upstate New York, what does that actually mean?
It just means that weather here sucks. Generally. Okay.
I didn't mean to trigger you. Just out of curiosity, what is a good weather day for you?
72 and sunny.
Hey, that's good.
And that's a gentle breeze.
Yeah.
Right?
That's sure.
Right? That's good anywhere.
Yeah. And what's
it's a crappy day.
What's a bad weather day for you?
Dude, 22 below?
No, what? 22 below what?
Zero.
No.
Zero Fahrenheit.
Nah.
It happens.
No. That doesn't make any sense. I'm so sorry. I'm like,
well,
I mean, look at what I have out there. There's just more
stop.
I know. I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm curious. I don't know. Wait, before we go on, do we have anything to add? Anything else, Hannah? Any thoughts on your mind right now about foosball and anything else going on?
Not for this weekend, I don't think. No, I was just looking at my calendar. Nope, nothing else for this week. Just want to chat about Illinois.
Yeah. Cool.
I think there were German championships this past weekend also. Kept up with it a bit, but not anything in depth. There is a new squad kind of taking some new wins, and it's called Fusen Nation. So you guys could check them out on Instagram and stuff. They have a pretty cool young team. And they're taking down some big dogs, so that was kind of fun for me to watch. We had a call with the Bears this past weekend. It was pretty fun chatting with all my teammates. But, yep, that's about all I got this week.
Yeah. No, the stream looked really clean out there, too. It was really nice.
Sure.
It's as you would expect. Great production quality. Tom, anything from you?
Well, you know, we're looking forward, of course, to the Bonzini Championship, the Open, happening May 19th, which I believe Hannah's going to be there. So you're getting
nice.
You're getting practiced up on Bonzini, are you? You're doing a little Bonzini practice?
I have. I've made a schedule, but I honestly haven't done much of it. So I don't know how good the schedule is going to be if I don't do it. Usually it doesn't work out that well, but you know, maybe I'll like put it under my pillow and sleep and it'll like sink into my brain the things I should have practiced.
Osmosis.
So it's worth a shot. Yep. That's where I'm at.
Where do you find your Bonzini table nearby?
Where did I find it?
Yep. Yeah. Where is it?
It's in my living room right now. Oh, I found it.
You have a Bonzini.
Yeah.
Table.
Yeah. I have a Bonzini, a Leo, and a Tornado in my house. Wow. I had to move out three couches, some carpet. Like we remodeled the entire living room just for foosball.
Wow. A lot of people wouldn't understand that.
You continue to impress. That's all there is to it. You've got a Bonzini in the house. That's, I mean,
what? Yeah.
I'll tell you what I'm more impressed by is that you have three couches.
I have
half a couch.
Yeah, I had like one on this side, like a big one here, the TV so you could like sit and watch it on either couch, and then like two recliners. We moved all that out. Now we just have like a little small couch and the two little mat like set of recliners, so we sit on that and like wow. It's really just us. So it's me and my dog, and my dog loves to sit wherever we are but not on furniture. So we just kicked out a couch and a half. Really two full ones and got a newer, smaller one. But yeah, had to make room for the tables. It's clearly a priority. You know, it's not like we have friends that want to like come sit on our couch. They would much rather come and like play foosball. So works out great.
Oh,
Hannah, could I introduce you to my wife and have a conversation with her about having a foosball table in the house?
You have to be careful. I've found that not everyone wants a foosball table in their house. Trust me. But I'm down for it.
I've been banished from the garage. That's where my table is. So
I wish I had a garage to have a foosball table. We would have to get rid of half our furniture to be able to have a foosball table in our little 800 square foot house. But anyway,
just sleep underneath it. Yeah, sleep underneath your table.
That wouldn't be the first time I've slept underneath a foosball table.
That's it right there. That's it right there.
No, I miss that. I miss being young. Wow, that got dark. Hey, so anyways.
Whoa.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
Next.
I know. Up next.
Whoa. Yeah.
I forgot what the connective tissue there was to transition, but let's just go. Let's just start talking about the Illinois State and bring in our guest who I've never had a chance to actually talk to him outside of a hello here and there, but Kenneth Dale. Ken, how's it going, buddy?
Well, it's going great, you know. I'm playing foosball, living the dream. Can't complain.
You are living the dream. You are everywhere. Yeah. I go to a lot of foosball tournaments because of the broadcasting and all that. You go to way more tournaments than I do, and I go to a lot. Like, what is that like? You living out of your luggage?
Yeah, pretty much. Nowadays, I have to carry a bigger luggage just for the trophies, you know.
Yeah, but, look at you.
Spoken like a true pro.
Yeah. I you know, stay in people's couches or, you know, beds, bedrooms, whatever. Anybody who will house me, you know, I don't really have a place in the States, but I spend a lot of time here because this is my main location where I tour.
So you're couch surfing and touring, basically, kind of thing. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Cool.
What do you do? No, but that really does raise a question because I know you're getting hardware. Like, what do you do with it? You send it back? Like
with the hardware? Well, yeah. I barely have any space in my room left to sleep.
Wow.
But no, it's not that bad. But I do have a lot of trophies in my room. I remember there's a guy that worked on my room and he built the cabinet for the trophies that I had at the time. And the funny thing is he created these slots that were designed for specific trophies. So it had like very perfectly sized slot for each trophy. And I thought, do you really think that's the last trophies I will win ever? I mean, so like all the other trophies, there's no space for them because he made it the exact number of slots for the trophies that I had at the time.
How do you know what the size of the trophy is going to look like?
Well, I had some trophies laying around, so he was like, let me build a cabinet for these trophies.
Florida State. Okay.
And he like made this. A specific slot for each one.
Got it. Wow.
Yeah. So... I mean, it's nice to have trophies. That's what I always played for, you know, more than the money or anything else.
What kind of hardware did you earn at Illinois State?
I won pro singles. Nice. I got, the Kenneth Dale Invitation, that's what they call it. I got third in open singles, but there was no trophy for third place. So basically, my hardware was that one, the Pro Singles one.
Awesome. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you. I'm happy about it.
So, everyone wants to know, I think, the Kenneth Dale Invitational, the Pro Singles title. How many Pro Singles titles have you won?
Man, oh my God. I haven't really counted them, but maybe 7, 8, I don't know.
Wow.
Something like that.
That's awesome. You were like, yeah, I won Pro Singles. And I was like, yeah, meanwhile, grass is still green. So what's next? Yeah, what else did you do? No, I'm not taking away from your comments.
It doesn't get old, though. It doesn't get old.
Oh, I'm sure it doesn't. No. And for me, pro is a category that kind of gets traveled through, if that makes sense. So, you know, I don't feel like you would be very upset if you got bumped to master in singles.
Why? You don't feel I would be very upset?
Probably not. I mean, you've had your chance to win 9 of them. You're a great single player. You're competitive in open singles.
For sure.
So I don't see, you know, you'd be excited, I'm sure, to be a master of your sport, and now you're in open singles. But the pro division to me is one that gets traveled through. So there are players that do get stuck there, sure. But in reality, the level of competition varies so much for me during the pro event. So you have times throughout your foosball career where pro doubles is so hard to win. Pro singles is so hard to win because you have 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Well, what happens when they move up? It's like, woo, refreshed. Now we have a whole new group of pros. And you have those that haven't moved up that are still competitive, but it's not so much a gatekeeping type of thing per se. And you're definitely a gatekeeper as you've been winning multiple pro singles titles, placing well in open singles. And that's a huge accomplishment. So congratulations for being the top of the game. That's a big deal, Ken.
Thank you. Yeah. It doesn't come easy. You know, you have to put in the time, dedication, you know, but I think if you work hard and smart, you can get anywhere as high as you want, I think.
And I guess I'll speak to this a little bit. I know we're talking about Illinois State, but I got to talk about you for a minute because you're my buddy. So one of the first tournaments I saw you come to play at, your game was exceptionally different than your current setup now. So, you know, you shot a pull shot, you did some other different things.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I've played with you then, I've played with you now, and I got to kind of see your game evolve. So what clicked in your brain to say, you know, I don't want to stick with the same strategy that I've been doing. I want to try to do this and shift it towards your new strategy. Can you kind of talk us through that process for you?
Yeah, sure. So the person that introduced me to foosball was my dad, and he had no idea about, you know, the pro tour or whatever. I just played against him. Sometimes we played for money, and I always liked to tic-tac the ball. It was one of the first skills I learned. Eventually, I found out about this pro tour thing, and everybody told me that the only way to win was a pull shot or a snake shot. So I kind of believed them for a while. And sure enough, like it, shooting a pull shot got me places, and I was able to beat, you know, the normal people, the average players. I would beat them with a pull shot, and it is an effective shot. But then there's a point where you learn enough about the game and you become good enough to realize that what people told you is not really true, and there are no rules that are set in stone. And once you understand enough, you can kind of like bend or break the rules. And I knew that I always enjoyed, you know, moving the ball, tic-tacking the ball. I didn't really like shooting a pull shot because I didn't like sitting on the ball like that. And then actually I got tennis elbow from shooting it, and that was like the perfect excuse to like switch my shot. Because I tried switching my shot, but because it wasn't effective, I would always come back to my main shot. But when I got like the tennis elbow, I had a hard time shooting my main shot, so it was the perfect excuse to start working on the shot that I really wanted to play with.
Can you walk us through your Tic Tac? I mean, you don't have to give away government secrets about how it works for you, right? Because, you know, I think a lot of people are mystified by it. But it is very effective, and I'm just wondering, what kind of mindset do you go into with it?
I know that there's people in the past that I've seen that shot a Tic Tac, you know, especially like the more well-known people. Like in Europe, there's Laszlo Teke. I've heard about John Zoller as well. Liam Lee also shoots one. So I see that some people like to use fakes, and their toss is like slow, and they use fakes, deception to move you off the hole. I don't have the same logic. I think I don't shoot the same logic as a Tic Tac. I think I just like moving the ball around, and I treat it like any other shot. Like my normal setup is Tic Tacking the ball, and I just like read the hole and just try to shoot at the open hole instead of like faking you out. So it's meant to be a fast shot, and rather than using deception, I want to beat people to the hole. And I just read it like I would any other shot. I just like moving the ball around.
So you don't really have like a...
No, I think that's...
Oh, go ahead.
I think that's cool because a lot of people really truly enjoy shooting shots, and it's not always what you would use and choose to win on tour, but it's cool that you have manipulated that into something that works for you to win on tour, as well as, you know, it's something you truly enjoy doing. So that is nice. That's odd, I think. You know, yeah, of course, everyone likes tic-tacking the ball, but, like, is that my best way to win? Maybe not, you know, but so we actually at my house can, I don't know if I've told you this or not, but we play, you know, pretty much every day. And sometimes I'll play Ken Dale style. So I try your Tic Tac series, the far wall. I try all the things that I've seen you do on tour. Yeah. And Bracklin just hates it. He's like, oh my gosh. And so like sometimes we'll play Ken Dale style because we're both terrible at it. You know, we're not like good. So I end up like cutting some back, and like they go in when they really shouldn't. But it's so much fun. We have a blast. So we try. Yeah. That's all I can say.
No, that's very flattering. And you have told me that before. So I find that very flattering. And I think I'm not at the point where I can be considered like one of the top players, but I'm glad to be attracting some attention from shooting a different shot. So I'm happy about that, and quite flattered by it.
Well, Ken, if there is certainly something that people are imitating that you're doing, there must have been a time in your career as an up and coming player where you had somebody that you watched that you emulated. Who would that have been?
I would say I was a fan of Fred Collignon. So I used to do brush passes, and I tried to emulate my brush passing game based on him. I was a fan of Tony in like when I used to watch Inside Foods videos in the beginning, but because I didn't shoot a snake shot, and the reason I didn't shoot a snake shot is because back when I started, I would play on these tables, like these Walmart-style tables that had the shiny soccer ball. So it was impossible to pin the ball. So I had to stick with the, you know, I would have chosen to shoot a snake shot if I had the choice, but it was impossible to pin the ball, so I shot a pull shot. So even though I loved Tony's game because it was different, I couldn't emulate his style based on the tables that I was playing on. Of course, I looked at Lofredo and Gummison and all these pull shots. I shot the pull shot, but I didn't really like the pull shot. I just felt like it was the only way to win. And people would even tell me like, and forget about the push, you know, the push sucks. Mm-hmm. And I always ask why. It's like, it just sucks. And sometimes people would give me different reasons, but then there's people like Sullivan that, you know, prove people wrong. So it's nice to try to do things that people don't think are like, that makes sense or are even possible, you know,
so. Unconventional and unexpected.
Yeah. And it's nice to change people's minds. Like if people think there's only one way to play or one way to win, it's always nice to like open up different possibilities. And so, because then it becomes more dynamic and there's so much to foosball that I think also has not been explored yet.
Well, that's an interesting statement.
One of the things that I think hasn't been exploited to its full potential is a 2-5 in doubles. I see very basic series and not enough. I think shooting in doubles is not very effective. So I think there's definitely a lot to explore in terms of the goalie game in doubles. That's one. There's probably a lot more. From any rod, I think there's a lot of possibilities that probably I haven't thought of and nobody has.
I agree. And the more I play multi-table and I don't have to rely on just trying to fit a tornado game into a multi-table, like onto a Bonzini, you know, I'm practicing for Bonzini. Well, what are the things I'm practicing? Well, I'm practicing cut shots. I'm practicing, you know, different angles, different pins, different banks, things that I really wouldn't do on a tornado usually. But then we go back and forth and then we go back to play tornado and I try some of those things and I'm like, wow, I could score that every time if I could execute it here, because no one runs defense based around that. You know, it's like little silly stuff, but you notice it more the more tables you play on, because you can't just rely on the same old game, I guess.
Yeah, I've noticed that there's so many different things that are, well, that seem possible on other tables, but they're also possible on Tornado, just people haven't thought about him.
Exactly.
And people tend to follow the leaders, so if one person does something that works, all of a sudden people start following them and trying to emulate them. So that also causes this thing where people gravitate to one style instead of like being super creative. So that also has an influence.
And I think it, you know, I think you have an advantage against players that may haven't played that style in a while. They're used to, or, you know, say people that just got into the game, all they've seen really is like a rollover dominated game. They're not used to set shots, especially not a push kick, you know, or a tic-tac series. And I think that's why Sullivan has a ton of, you know, she's great and her push shot's amazing, but like I think she has an added factor to beating some players because they don't know how to block a push shot. You know, it's like, how many times do you block a push shot on tour in a competitive setting? And like, you better figure it out because she's going to shoot it. You know what I mean? So I think that gives her an advantage. I think that gives you an advantage instead of just set it up and shoot a rollover. I think this is might be not said so well, but I'm going to say it because I shoot a rollover and I can get away with it. I think sometimes people score rollovers much more accidentally and they can run into you defensively instead of when you shoot a one stroke shot. I think it's much, you know, it can be much more difficult to block a one stroke shot in comparison to a rollover, because you'll shoot people that don't even know how to play foosball really. And they'll run into a greatly time or a really well thought out snake shot. And you're like, how did this ding dong block me? You know, they had no idea, but they ran into it and you're just like, dang it. So I don't know. Maybe that's just my thoughts, but.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, about the snake shot. But I do agree with it being an advantage when people are not used to it. Yeah. I think if everybody shot a push shot and everybody shot the shot that I shoot, then it would be much harder to score, for sure.
Absolutely.
Where did you learn that shot?
I blocked the snake shot well because I've seen it so many times.
Yeah,
so
many exactly.
It's a predominant shot. But I'm curious, what did you? I know you were saying that you like the tic-tac, that, but, and what did you study that? Did you watch somebody else's? Did you base it off that, or did you just kind of like figure it out on your own?
I tried to look at the people that were shooting the tic-tac, but I actually didn't like that style because I actually like to tic-tac the ball fast. And a lot of the styles I saw were kind of like slower tic-tac. Mm. So I didn't like it that much. So there was really nobody I could really watch and that I would say that I want to shoot like that. And I did get some inspiration. Like, I even got the chance to talk to John Zoller, even Lars Lotteke when I went to Austria. And they did give me a lot of very useful tips. They're not always easy to incorporate because it's a different, like, way of seeing the shot and seeing the holes. So yeah, I would say I tried to do my own thing in a way.
And go ahead, Tom.
No. I was just going to say, when it comes to European play, what stands out to you the most when it comes to European as opposed to the American? Or I guess if we want to go back in time, say the Texas style of playing. Okay. What differs most to you?
Stands out most to me? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, there's two aspects. Well, like, one is the actual game style, and the other one is the foosball scene. So, for example, in terms of the game style, I think it's highly influenced by the table. Like, certain tables, like, make certain moves easier. Like, Tornado is a very precision table, and it favors, like, dragging the ball laterally because the roll is straight, whereas the European tables rely more on pinning for ball control.
Yes.
So that leads to different types of shots. And also the grippiness, like, it allows you to, like, pin and control the ball in a much more fluid way when pinning. So that leads to different, you know, styles, like the front pin shot, the cut shots, and all this stuff. So it is influenced a lot by the tables. In terms of the skill levels, I do have the impression that there's more players in Europe. I've been to Europe, and their foosball scene, I really love it. It's a lot of people, a lot of young people, very, very fun, very social. I've heard this concept before, but people do consider that in America, the elite level is higher than in Europe. But in Europe, there's, like, more players, perhaps.
No question.
There are a lot of elite players in Europe as well. And it's different. It's different, and it's really great when you get to experience both, because it gives you, like, two different perspectives.
If you take Germany, for example, it's not uncommon, and we've had conversations with people from Germany about the fact that if you go into any workplace in Germany, if it's a good enough size staff, they've typically got a foosball table in their break room in just about every company. So, and then if you go to a soccer stadium, or, well, I guess you'd say football stadium.
Okay.
You go to the football stadium, and around the outside of the football stadium are foosball tables or table soccer or table football, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, soccer's fine with me.
Yeah. But it's that prevalent by comparison to us. You got to really seek it out. You got to find it. You got to really do your research to find a good foosball table.
The soccer connection really does help a lot. I mean, I feel like if you are a soccer fan and you see a foosball table, you're automatically a foosball fan because you're related to soccer. And because soccer has so many fans, then foosball has a lot of fans, I guess.
Oh, yeah. It's hip and cool.
And I was in Germany. When I was in college, I went for 6 months to Germany. That's where I actually learned. Actually, I tell this to some people, like, the reason on my 2-5, the reason that I don't bounce the ball off the walls like a lot of people do is because in Germany, in the P4P rules, you're not allowed to bounce the ball 3 times on the 2-bar.
Oh.
So that's the reason I developed that style of passing. Yeah, pretty much the only reason. And the reason I do near wall is just coincidence. Like, years after that, I realized, like, how uncomfortable is it to drag the 2-bar all the way here? It's so uncomfortable. But at that point, it was too late. Like, oh, now I understand why people do far well more. So, but yeah, Europe's really fun. I really want to go back. I've been to the last World Cups, and cool, just amazing. It's a different experience, for sure.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And, you know, I guess, like, you seem American to all of us because you've just been on the American tour forever, but you're not. So it is cool. You know, you're from one country, and then you're picking up pieces of your foosball game from a different part of the world, and you're crafting those things into this one game to bring it to the American tour. So, like, that's pretty neat how that is really structured and, like, based your game. You know, you said you played with your dad, and then, you know, that you picked up these things from playing in Germany. So that's really, really cool that you've had the opportunity to travel and to gain that much to base your structure of foosball around. I don't think many people have that opportunity. So I think you've really done something interesting with that opportunity to craft that into part of your game. So very, very cool.
Yeah. In Europe, I used to shoot a pole shot, and that was weird for shooting a pole shot, you know? Like I would hit one pole shot and they would be so impressed. Oh my God, you actually like scored a pole shot, you know, on the German table. So, and that was just starting out, you know, I was a low level player, but for some reason like pole shot was considered like really skillful on these tables or something.
So,
Oh, do you have difficulty tic-tacking on a Bonzini?
well, Bonzini, I had difficulty with everything, but it's kind of growing on me a little bit. I happened to play on one on in the recent Florida State Championships, and they had a Bonzini out there, and I did play a lot of pickup games. It's starting to grow on me a little bit. My ball control is a little better now, and I did try my tic tac and I scored a few good tic tacs, so I'm hopeful that I might be able to.
Interesting.
Do you is it so I want to talk about your touring career here in the US. A lot of it has to do with kind of going, because you're working for IFP and you're doing setup and teardown. Is that a difficult thing to kind of go back and forth? Because like this weekend, Illinois State, right? You were doing setup and teardown. Does that affect how you end up ultimately playing, or is that even not even a thing for you?
I don't think it affects me, honestly. Even though it's tiring, like I feel like I might get tired in a different way, but not in a foosball way. Like if you play foosball a lot, you might get tired in a foosball way. Like you'll get sore in the right places where you do your shot or your pass or whatever. But when I do setup and teardown, it doesn't use the same like. I don't know. It seems like it doesn't use the same muscle groups or tendons or whatever it is. So my game is fine after setup and teardown.
But you're not
The
overly
only thing that might affect
focused
it
on it.
is, yeah, if it affects my sleep, like if I don't sleep after setup and teardown, I might be physically not in the best condition. But usually it's not an issue. No, I've been used to doing that for since late 2018. So maybe I can't remember what it was to just like play and not have to do that. So maybe I just got so used to it that I can't even tell the difference anymore.
Wow. And how many tournaments? I mean, barring the pandemic and COVID and all that, how many tournaments a year have you kind of been hitting on average?
I know that in 2019, I would bet that there was nobody in the world that went to as many tournaments, because in 2019 I went to pretty much every single IFP tournament except for one, which was pretty much all the tournaments that were going on at the time in the States. But apart from that, I went to the World Cup, and during this couple month break, I actually went on to several European tournaments as well. Like I went to a tournament in Germany, I went to a tournament in Austria, a tournament in Bulgaria. So it was like so many tournaments. That year was probably like 20 tournaments.
Jeez.
That's amazing.
I'm gonna talk, we're not talking DYPs, we're talking like, you know.
Like rated, professional tournaments.
Wow.
That's extraordinary. Yeah, what is it that, do you have a title with IFP? Do you have like a, are you in charge of
So I don't I wouldn't say that I work for IFP. Like I'm not employed by IFP. I just help set up the tables, and I get, certain comp like compensation in return, like entry fees and stuff like that. I do stuff for IFP, of course, but I'm not like a formal employee or anything like that, and I'm not allowed to be employed because I had just have a tourist visa. So and I don't get a salary, and I don't get a like a salary, like hourly and monthly or whatever. But I do get stuff in return, like things comp tips,
Compensation. Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy the the setup and the teardown?
Well, this is the thing, I'm more of a like a math guy, like
right.
So like physical, like, you know, hammer stuff is not, it's not my natural forte. And but, you know, I do what it takes to, you know, do my dream, you know. So I gotta enjoy it. I enjoy it insofar as it makes my dream possible, you know.
Yeah,
I do what it takes.
Yeah, playing as much as you can at as many tour stops as possible. I think you figured it out here. This is a great idea.
It is a great idea if you want to like be the best, you know.
Sure.
And of course, that's just a piece of the puzzle. You know, you have. Well, at least I feel like apart from touring, I have to practice. Apart mm-hmm. from practice, I have to work on my strategy. I have to analyze the game. You know, I have to work on my mentality, you know, mental training, you know. So right. There's multiple aspects.
Well, we know that Tony Spraydeman is one of the few pros, pro masters that are out there who actually makes a living doing this.
Yeah.
What do you think needs to change within the industry of or the sport of foosball to make that possible for someone like yourself?
Well, sponsors, of course. I think people that are out of, like, it should be a spectator sport so that it attracts viewership. Mm-hmm. That are not necessarily foosball players, because there aren't that many foosball players in the big picture. So if it was widely available for people to watch and it was entertaining and you could draw an audience, that would attract sponsors, I think.
Oh, automatically. Yeah, for sure.
Now, the actual steps to get there, I wouldn't know, because it's not like, I'm not an expert in that area,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, that's what I think.
No, I think that has a great point. And you know, like you said, you went to World Cup. Well, this past World Cup, you had kids taking field trips to come and see the World Cup. Like,
yeah,
that was crazy. There was hundreds of kids there. And, you know, even when I was a kid playing foosball, people would be had the mindset of, wow, that kid can do it. I can definitely do it. I mean, she's standing there playing with men on a table. You know, it's not like I'm in the Olympics having to pole vault over someone's house or something crazy. You know, like that's like, wow, no, I could never do that. You know, it's like foosball is a platform for everyone. I think, you know, men and women, it doesn't matter that a man can bench press 300 more pounds than I do when it comes to foosball. Doesn't matter. That's pretty level. You right. know what I mean? I like that aspect about it. I like the aspect that you don't have to be in shape. You can still be the best in the world, and it doesn't matter if you can run a mile. No one cares. It's just like so many aspects of no one cares. If you want to be good, you can be good. Like, and I love sports like that. I think that's a cool aspect of foosball that isn't marketed yet. You know? What if we got, you know, people that were ultra competitive before and they had an injury and, you know, then they got into foosball and they could do foosball because, you know, yeah, you broke your foot. Well, what are you going to do when you're sitting on your house for however long getting your foot back healed? Well, get you a bar stool and prop it up and learn how to play foosball. you know, it's just, it can be marketed so many different cool ways, I think, that we're missing out on because it's something for everyone. And I think, you know, getting kids involved and like Ken said, getting more people involved, even if they're as a spectator, you know, I think that's huge to grow foosball. And I think it levels the playing field so much when you have a buddy that, you know, you can show him how to shoot a pull shot and he can hit the ball in like a few tries. How cool. Great. Now that playing field's level for him. And he has this idea in his head like, man, you know, if I had a place to practice and I really wanted to get good at this, I could. But there has to be incentive, like Ken said, with sponsors to get good, you know, mm-hmm. because unless you have this perfect dream setup of you're 20, you have plenty of money, you don't have any kids, you're not married, you don't have any responsibilities at home that you can just go and leave and play foosball and travel. You know, unless you're really blessed and have that, it's not that readily available for everyone. So, like Ken said, I'm no expert in figuring out how to make foosball great again, but I think these are steps along the way that you could use if someone did have a great plan that they could, you know, take from here and there. But definitely has to involve getting the spectators into the game.
Right. Yeah, I mean, out of the people that watch the Super Bowl, what percentage actually play football, you know?
Right.
Exactly. But they all have a football in their homes or have thrown a football in their lives, you know, like, but there's a big percentage of people that have somewhat kicked a foosball around in their lives too.
before I got into foosball, I went to, you know, a friend's house and they'll have a foosball table, you know, and they're not foosball players, but everybody had, well, a lot of people have played foosball.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. And I think if we want foosball to be anything more than it is, if that's what we want, because foosball is a niche sport. Foosball is something that not a lot of people do at a level that they would go drop a grand to go play at a foosball tournament outside of maybe hanging out at a local thing. But, you know, we have to start looking at how foosball was never great in the sense that it was never making money for anybody that was running it. It was making money. Tournaments were not making money for the people that were running it. Tournaments were just there to sell foosball tables. Tom, we talked to Cal Rogers about that, and that's the big thing. Yes. Like, foosball cannot reach those kind of heights because it's just not the current setup. Unless, as you all are talking about, what we're talking about is, you know, there's how many thousands of people, tens of thousands of people have tables in their house. Mm-hmm. Why not get them? Why not? So I think the bridge here is a media gap that's not happening for foosball, that is not getting through TikTok, through Instagram, through whatever matches, tournaments, or whatever in people's houses that can be rooting for them, because you're right, all of you. I mean, this is 100% correct. I love baseball. I cannot play baseball, but I love it. I'll watch it. And I think that same thing can kind of happen for foosball. It's just the problem is that we need to kind of bridge that gap between the golden era of foosball that we know of in the 70s when we had those huge tournaments. It was all done at a loss by the people that are running it. And what we can do now with the technology that we have, and look at us, we're all in different parts of the country being able to talk to each other and streaming. Yeah. And I don't know how many people are going to see this, and hundreds are right now, and hundreds are going to see it later. So I don't know. The possibilities are the sky's the limit, darn it. I'm really excited.
And what you're doing right now is actually part of what needs to be done, you know, because you're like publishing these things out there where people can see it. So that's definitely a big part of it.
And sharing
it on social media and all this stuff. So
no doubt. And, you know, we've talked before to previous people on the podcast, like, man, we should get a group of you guys together. You've got so many great ideas. Well, my new input for that is that we need one of those people on that group, if we ever make it, to be from Europe. Because, you know, I spoke with some friends from Germany and they were like, yeah, we had 140 people at our tournament, at our draw this past week. And I was like, what? That's bananas. What? But, you know, they did. I know. It's crazy.
At a draw?
And, you know, DYP, nothing, 80 teams. And I was like, oh, yeah, very cool.
80 teams.
It was crazy. I couldn't even fathom that, you know. And we're going to talk to some of those guys that were telling me this in a few days, hopefully. And maybe we can get something from them that can go into that group. And, you know, Adam mentioned TikTok. I've never had TikTok. Don't care about TikTok. One of my redneck buddies from little bitty Mississippi randomly sends me this message on Instagram like, hey, bro, what's up? I was flipping through TikTok the other night and think I saw you on TikTok. And I was like, I don't have TikTok. What are you talking about? And so he sends me this link and I open it up and it's Lynn Tran's like, oh, I just played in the US and she has like her like clips of everyone. And I guess I happen to be in one of them. And so he sends it to me and it was like, yeah, man, I saw you. I knew you were going to be in the video. I saw it on TikTok. And I was like, you don't know Lynn. You're from Decatur. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way. Why are you on TikTok? Why? You know? And he was like, yeah, just randomly popped up. And, but that was cool to me, you know, but it comes full circle back to the Europe thing. You know, if it wasn't for Lynn and whatever she's got going on in Europe, maybe my redneck buddy would have never seen that, you know. But it's a gap for sure. So I definitely agree with you guys that social media is a huge part of it these days. We were talking about marketing some other stuff earlier today and I was like, well, you know, when I was in school, we didn't really use TikTok or Instagram to market. You know, my marketing classes weren't built around that.
Yep.
news is today they have to be. So it's kind of like navigating water you don't really know. But yeah, I think that's definitely a missing piece of the puzzle for sure.
So Ken, a quick question. when it comes to the internet, I was spending some time last night before I went out to practice. I went into the videos on YouTube that you can find when it comes to instructions for basics. And believe me, I need the basics. But when it comes to that, I found some interesting ideas and some other comments and some other things that were going on when it comes to training. What do you think about that? Is it valuable or is it something that that really isn't necessary?
I think it's valuable to a lot of people. Especially beginners that want to get into the game and learn the basics. So it does have like a place, and it is useful, and it definitely attracts viewership. Like, I've seen some of the most watched videos on YouTube are actually tutorial videos, and there are several channels that are, you know, popular. And I think there are people that are outside of foosball that watch those videos and they're curious, and they're enjoyable too, and they're interesting. So I think it's definitely part of the content that needs to be put out there. And I personally did watch tutorial videos when I was, you know, when I was not on the tour, and I was trying to, you know. So they are useful. And then of course the other question would be, are they useful to me at the moment? And that's a different question, because I think the people who do tutorials are very skilled people, but as any other player, like, everybody sees foosball in a different way. So I do find that tutorial videos will have a certain level of bias either way. So I might be learning something useful, but it's always from the perspective of who's teaching it. Even if I did a tutorial video, it would have a bias based on how I view the game. Sure. So I think the thing with tutorial videos, they might open up your mind to this perspective of seeing strategy and everything. But as long as you're open to the fact that there are other strategies out there, then it's fine.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable, because I was just watching a video last night where the person who was conducting the video said that they, because of the physics behind it, the push shot is not a good shot, and it's not a good bet. And I'm thinking, wait. Sullivan Rue maybe has never watched this video. Sullivan Rue is making the physics work beautifully for her push shot. So I'm not exactly sure how I would take that.
I'm not on board with anything that tells you can't do something or you shouldn't do something. I'm always on board with when people say you can do something. So anytime somebody says you can't do something, like, I tend to disagree. It tends to make me want to do it just to prove him wrong, you know?
Right.
I think that's what I do with my shot too. Like, you can't imagine how many people told me that I shouldn't shoot that shot from the very beginning. Like, all of my foosball friends told me that, almost really? With no exception. Yeah, the only people who supported it were a couple of people that, you know, that were, let's say, they liked my game, but they weren't, like, part of, like, the elite group of players or you know, top players, you know.
Right.
Almost every single top player told me that I shouldn't shoot that shot. It wasn't effective. So,
We have a push shooter here in the Northeast, Stan Pulowski.
Absolutely, I know.
Is a beast with that push shot.
Oh, that's he has an amazing, amazing push shot. Yeah,
he's a super strong guy. But I mean, I think his perspective, because he is in a wheelchair. But still, you know, the physics for him works beautifully. So, wondering about that philosophy. Don't use that shot.
Yeah. Well,
the person who said that, I want to see them play at Stan Pulowski.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, like Stan. Stan has like guns of steel, okay? The dude is jacked.
Yeah.
So you take that, and no offense to my girl Sully, her arms are not exactly built like Stan's, yet they both have absolutely romping push shots.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just like you can do both. Back to my, it's not limited by that thing again. It doesn't matter, you know? But a really cool idea you brought up, Ken, was that, you know, what if someone heard that tutorial and decided not to shoot a push shot? What if along learning the basics of foosball, I learned to push, a pull, a push kick, a push, whatever, you know, I did it all. And I got to a point where I was getting really good at something and someone said, ah, you better quit. That one's not going to get you far, kid. You might want to shoot a rollover. What, how many people have been, you know, tricked into that we could have 15 more Sullivan Ruse and 15 more Stan Pulowskis and other people that shoot push shots? You know, they're not the anomaly. They're the ones that stuck with something that worked for them, you know, but how many other people could have been swayed from doing the same thing? And then we could have had a bigger base of people shooting push shots, or not just push shots in general, but you know, you get the gist. That's interesting.
If I may interject, this is what pisses me off about the whole, the foosball, or the rollover ruined foosball, not enough diversity argument. It infuriates me to hear that because people are blaming the wrong thing. Having the option to do something does not, in fact, make that the problem. It's just people chose to go that way. If you want to argue about that and get upset about there being the rollover being legal, you should be upset about the people that chose not to do it because it takes a little bit more work. Ken, your resume shows that a tic-tac does, in fact, work. Sullivan's resume shows, in fact, a push shot does work, right? So I cannot stand when we get wrapped up in that concept that, you know, well, this one shot's available, because I know way more than most people do, I think, about how it was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you the same people and the same argument and the same passion to the people that were saying that it dumbed down the game when people started shooting the rollover. Those are the same people that started shooting a pull shot that were told the same damn thing back in the 70s. 100%. People chose to stop shooting back pins. They chose to stop shooting pull kicks and push kicks in favor of the pull shot because that was the thing. And on and on and on it goes. And it pisses me off. And I am shouting well, it loud.
I can see everybody shooting a pull shot and it being repetitive. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. And, you know, taking nothing away from these players, but looking at it through a different lens, say you take Sullivan's push shot away. Okay, tell her for 2 years, Sully, or for a year, you only get to shoot a pull shot. I've seen her pull shot. It's not her push, but it's also not bad. Okay, guess, you know, what if we factored in the fact that she's still going to get the ball so many times because her five bar is so good that it doesn't matter what shot she shoots. Okay, so she doesn't have her big romp and pull, push. She's shooting a pull, but she's going to get the ball five more times this game than you are. So odds are she's still going to kick your butt, you know, but like those are things that I also view putting myself in that situation. I don't think my shot's the best, but guess what? If I get the ball three more times than Billy across the table does this game, odds are I'm probably going to win. Okay. You know, so I always am down to look at it from that perspective as well. What if their five bars are just getting them the ball and they're okay. Their push shot's amazing. No doubt. But like, you know, what if you took it away? They would still be good. That's not the point. You know, their five bars are great. So I don't know. It's very cool to talk about how you can see it differently across, you know, different, you know, from someone shooting a different stroke or a different shot or whatever. But I guess my next question for you, Ken, this is kind of shifting gears and kind of putting you on the spot, but I'm going to do it because you're my buddy. So you tour so much, you've been to tons of tournaments. Tell me a few things that when you get to a tournament, like you're excited for, and tell me some things after the tournament that you're like, I really want this tournament to have like this, this, and this, or like some things you really look for when you're going to a tour stop. You've been to all of them. You have a lot of experience. What do you like about tournaments, or what do you miss when it's not there?
Winning.
Outside of winning.
Well, so when I go to a tournament, for me, it's like, even before it starts, it's almost like the first time. Like, I get the butterflies, I get the excitement. Like, a lot of times, the first night, I can't sleep. That was the way with my first tournament, and it's still true today. Like, I still feel the same exact excitement. I feel like I fall in love every time, once again, every tournament. So, just being at a tournament and competing is what makes me happy. And even before I play matches, like, I feel this sense of gratitude just that I have the opportunity to do it, because for the longest time, I actually tried really hard to make it possible for me to actually travel and tour. And it seemed impossible at certain times, because I tried really hard for a long time before everything just happened, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that I got there and just having the opportunity, like, I don't pay attention to, like, the details of what, like, some people, let's say, might complain about the wait times, or some people might complain that a certain event is single elimination, or some people might complain that, why is this person getting to play, you know, even about me, like, when I was expert, like, why does Kenneth get to play expert now? Maybe some people will start complaining, why do I play pro or something, but there's a lot of people that complain about certain things, or the venue, or the smoke in the bar, you know, whatever it is. I don't pay attention to any of that. Like, it really doesn't matter to me. Like, I played tournaments in all sorts of conditions, in all sorts of venues, and the only thing I care about is getting on a table and playing against somebody and having the thrill of competition. That's really all I care about. And I look forward to just playing the tournament and I'm just happy no matter what type of tournament it is. I guess that's my answer.
No, that's great.
No, I love that. That's great. That's awesome.
Are there any, like, specific things that I enjoy other than that? Some people also like, you know, the seeing their friends, or sometimes the partying and other aspects that are not directly related to the competition. And honestly, I didn't really care too much about that, but it's starting to grow on me. Like, for example, Illinois State was definitely a tournament that was special. Even though nothing, like, super special in particular happened, you know, there's sometimes some people that say hi to you tournament after tournament. And in the beginning, they're like, yeah, I've seen that face before, you know, like, hi, you know, exchange a few words. But there were several people this tournament that you know, they've said hi to me multiple times, but this time, like, we exchanged a little bit more talk. And there were several people that actually became, like, real people to me. It's like, huh, for the first time, I feel like I really get this person. I really understand who they are. And I actually saw them as, like, wow, this is my buddy. And they grew on me that way after, like, just being acquainted. So I felt, like, a deeper connection with several people this tournament that I had seen in the past. So it was very special. So I'm starting to enjoy other aspects as well, like the people I see. Even when I play against people, like, let's say I played, like, two rookies in, like, pro doubles or something, and there were a couple moments where I saw them, like, struggling, you know, and I could almost, like, totally relate to my feelings in certain matches. And I felt this connection, like, even though, like, let's say I ended up winning the match, I felt like, wow, I actually have this connection because I could feel it in their face, like, I've been there too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I approached them after that and had a conversation, and I was curious about their path in foosball, and I don't know, it was like a very deep experience for me.
Love that. That's so cool.
So helping others get better is something that is meaningful to you?
Yeah, well, I like helping others, but I think the main thing for me is, especially with newer players, I like them to feel good. Because one of the things is, like, when somebody is already addicted and they're really competitive, like, I don't feel bad about, like, beating them, right? But, like, if I see someone that is starting to get into the game and maybe they get frustrated, like, sure, I want to help them, but I also want to make them feel like even if they lose, it's okay. Like, you're still, like, valuable. It's like your identity is not attached to this foosball match that you just lost horribly, you know? Like, like, I'm still your friend. We're still friends. And foosball, just be patient. You know, you're not always going to lose. And just keep playing because there's a lot in it. So for the most part, I try to make people have a good time in foosball. Yeah, basically.
We need a lot more of that. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think we do. There's definitely people that scare away some players when they're starting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. And I like the idea of like gratitude, you know, and it's, I don't think that's something you're just coming on here and saying for people to hear. I don't think that's the case because, like I said, I've known you for a while. I've played with you. I've played against you. I've played, and I say that because, you know, it's not just like Ken gets to pay his way, show up and just check his text messages and go show up to a match. No, it's like when Ken and I are getting ready for a pro doubles match and it's relatively far out there. Well, we get called up to the table. We're both there. We're kind of getting wrapped up. And then Ken has to go level 3 tables. Well, and, you know, in my brain, I'm like, man, I hate that for Ken. He has to go and do something, you know, have to kind of go check into work and then come back and like get back into the right mindset for foosball. But, and you know, I've been on the other side where I'm playing a match and Ken has to come level my table. And it's just like, man, they're like, then I have to go to another table and have, Ken, can you come level my table? And it's like, man, I feel like I'm taking him away from, you know, the focus is his weekend and his results, but you never see that on your face. And you can tell that it is truly like, okay, I have to work to be able to do my dream is what you said, but you also act that way. You know, it's not just, I feel like you're genuinely like, okay, I'm going to go level the table and you come back, still have a great attitude and you're right back in it. And I think that's a big deal. So I truly believe that you said, you know, I'm grateful to be here. I'm just have so much gratitude when I get to every tournament. And I feel that way, you know, being your partner or, you know, opponent or just a player in a tournament, I can see that. So that's really great, Ken. And I'm glad that you have shifted it to be seen that way.
It's very easy to be grateful when you like living your dream life. I actually think gratitude is like almost like the way to actually get what you want. Like it's almost like energetic. I've studied the law of attraction, you know, a lot, which is basically like the power of thought and everything. So the feeling of gratitude is actually on the vibration that you already have something good. So you can actually make things happen in your life just by feeling grateful before you actually have them. So I am grateful also as a method of getting what I want, you know, because it's, I find that when you're grateful, like more good things happen. So, and of course the challenge is to be grateful when things aren't that good. But in my life, I mean, this is like exactly what I wanted, you know,
you're living the dream.
Wanting this for a long time. So it's really difficult not to,
you know, I have a question and kind of in that vein, you and I are very similar 20 years apart points wise. There was a time where I was 10 points away from being a pro master. You're 18 points away. It's a different point system.
Nice.
But do you feel like you're a pro master? Like, do you feel like if they bump, you know, you get the point. You've been winning, so obviously that's happening at some point. That's not my question. My question is, do you feel that way? Because that's something that I've often thought about my own self.
Yeah, I do feel I'm a master. I constantly am like measuring my own like skill. So I kind of like judge myself on a certain level. And my judgment was different like maybe 6 months ago. And maybe a year ago it was different. So if there were tiers, like for example, within master there are multiple like levels.
Yeah.
So let's say you divide master in master, master pro, master expert, master amateur, master rookie, master. So if you divide it in that way, I would say I'm master amateur. So I'm like almost average master, a little lower than average. That's what I would say I am at the moment.
And that begs a question because that's where I was stuck at. And I don't disagree with that layout because that sounds that sounds good. How within that. You're talking about a very narrow bandwidth of performance and ability, right?
Okay.
Master amateur to master expert, that gap is as wide as somebody that's never even existed in the world to like being a rookie at baseball, right?
Yeah.
There's a huge gap. And the four of us and people listening to this know what that means because it's huge, right? Yeah. But you know, so my question is like how do you quantify that? Like, how do you say that? Like, do you know how to get to the next steps? Because I never did. I have no idea how to do it.
Yeah, so even in those tiers, like I actually divided into the different aspects of my game, like 5-bar offense, 5-bar defense, 3-bar offense, zone, goalie defense, and 2-bar offense. So I can actually, I judge every aspect of my game in terms of those tiers. So for example, there was one point I could say like, oh, my, let's say my goalie defense is master. My, let's say my 5-bar is high pro. My, let's say my 5-bar offense is mid pro. So in the end, I average it all out, and it turns out my general. So I judge every aspect. But one way to quantify it is, for example, if I play a mid-tier master, and let's say I consider myself a mid-tier master, I would be expected to win 50% of the time, which is what I'm actually experiencing currently. Like some of the masters that I play, like for example, Joe Rhodes, I beat him once in Oklahoma. He beat me once. I beat him in Florida. So I'm kind of like beating masters, but I'm also getting beat, and I'm losing consistently against the top masters. So I'm not. I know I'm not there yet, but I'm doing okay against mid-tier to low masters. I kind of win some and lose some. So that's kind of what I'm using.
Who's mid-tier master to you and top-tier master?
So, of course, the master, I would put people like Tony Spraderman, Ryan Moore, sure. Billy Pappas. There's a few others, you know.
Brandon Munoz.
Brandon Munoz would probably be up there. And then... I'm not going to go into all of them just because I don't want to exclude anybody. Then, you know, the master pros would probably be like other people that maybe would not be expected to win like open singles against Tony. Like maybe Blake Robertson, Brandon Morland would be right under that. And then there's others. So for example, like I would put Joe Rose as like a master, like expert master or something like that, which is what I'm approaching, I feel. And of course, people might disagree with that, but I have my own idea.
Sure.
Of the
tiers. It's really fascinating to hear this, because the next question is, it sounds like that what you're talking about is based on the performance of others and the expectation of what you expect others to do.
Yeah.
Like Tony sounds like it's like he's the touchstone, he's the North Star. Tony leaves. What does that do to the makeup here?
Well, he would be one of the masters that would not be in that list. But of course, if none of the I guess if none of the top masters played anymore, I assume like based on the points, because at the end of the day, the master rating is a point rating. So if the points got adjusted where the lower tier becomes the highest tier, then maybe I would be higher rated as well. So it's subjective in the sense that it's based on points. So I'm not judging based on absolute values. I'm judging based on, you could even take the rankings, the IFP rankings, and just group them based on rankings, and they would work as well.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I like this discussion a lot, because when I was coming back into the game, so 6-ish years ago, I'd say, I had the skill to win, but I did not have the results to show, because I hadn't played in forever, and you know, whatever, I wasn't a master whenever I left. So it took me like probably like 4 years to become a master. And it was absolutely bananas to me, because I was beating these masters who hadn't won anything since back in the day, and then, but they still get the number one seed. See, that was an issue for me, because like, yeah, back in their prime, no doubt, they were the masters. They were head in charge. They was rolling through everybody. But it's like now, after when they come back, the game has changed. It's not the same. So, and I mean that because I was looking at, you know, the old Slingshot application, and, you know, it had everyone's rankings, and it hadn't been updated in a while, but we were going down through there, and there were some master men that I hadn't seen play foosball in 10 years. Maybe, you know, and it's just like, wow, they're still number 7. Like, that's crazy. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, if they came back now and played Hall of Fame in Vegas, do you think they deserve the number 7 seed? I don't know. Like, it's hard for me, because like over time, yes, of course, everything they've done in their career, I'm not trying to discredit, but like their points were gained at a time that didn't matter, you know, well, it didn't matter, but like in a previous time. So the evolution has changed so that, is that weighted differently now? you know, if these mid-level masters you speak of were sent back to pro, would they be master in three tournaments again because they're just crushing everybody in pro? Or would it be different because now pro's evolved? I don't know. I always talk about the pro section because it's like there is so much turnover there. You see these fiery expert players that get moved up to pro, but they die there. They never go any farther. And it's like, yeah, okay, whatever. And then you see these players that move up to pro and then they take over. And it's like, man, I'm so sick of beating Ken Dale. And like, yeah, I'm so sick of having to play Ken Dale and him beat me for top of winners and singles, you know? And it's just like, if Ken wasn't here, I would be getting third. So therefore Ken is a gatekeeper, right? But when Ken moves up, who's the new pro singles gatekeeper? So that's a thing and like a series we speak about at my house because I find that really intriguing. But the different levels of master is also intriguing. Something that's not discussed much because, you know, certain names will never be dropped below master. I don't care if they enter and lose every tournament they ever play in. They're going to be masters. And that's fine. I guess that's an earned title thing. But it is odd when the points come into play. And there was a big points reset 2 years ago, I believe, that really leveled the play. And I guess here's an example. When me and Sullivan won our first world title, we were the 14th seed in women's doubles. Okay? Wow. And it was like, and it was bananas. And like when she won her first world title, I don't think she was even close to a top seed. I think we were like something crazy. You know what I mean? And we're making it higher, but we had no points. And I think that was kind of when everyone realized that, okay, these points kind of need to be redone. You know, there's some players that were almost to 10,000 points or something crazy, you know, and it's like, I don't even play that much anymore, but they've played for so long. They've, you know, gathered this many points throughout time. So that's a very interesting topic. I didn't mean to ramble there, but I think that's an idea that could be discussed further by different groups of people and you would have different answers every time.
When you take into account people that haven't played in a long time, it really changes the equation because you don't really know what you're going to get. So the system that I use is only accurate with currently active players because if they are currently active and they've been playing tournaments, eventually their points will match their skill. So it's really hard to judge when people haven't played in a long time, you know? And in terms of the masters that will never be dropped down, I think it's more of a mindset thing. Like there's a master mindset where they know so much about the game that even if they get rusty physically, their mentality and their strategy is still master level. So I think that's probably one of the factors. And the point system is not perfect, of course. But I feel like with currently active players, if they tour a lot and play a lot, the actual placements, like the order of the rankings, should be fairly accurate.
Sure. And that's something, you know, I was talking to a few of the people on the points committee, and that was something we ran into going into Worlds last year. Mm-hmm. Your number one seed has played two tournaments this year. One of them they won and they were fabulous and they crushed everybody. Sure. The other one they did, you know, they got like 9th, 12th, but they didn't lose points because it was a modern foosball tournament. And so it was like going into Worlds, is this person still be one or not because they've played two tournaments? It was just like, and it wasn't necessarily the number one seed we were talking about, but it follows along those lines. So it was just interesting to me to see how that works organically.
Yeah. I'm sure there are a lot of intricacies that I wouldn't know what the proper solution is. And there's a lot of like special case scenarios. Like when I switched my shot, I was winning expert singles at the time with the pull shot. But when I switched my shot for a little bit, like I got 49th in expert singles, you know, I was one of the top seeds. So it's like there's a lot of factors that can come into play that are hard to really pinpoint with any system, with any point system. So there's a lot of special cases.
Well, Ken, are there too many levels? I mean, are there too many rank? Like you've got, what is it now? Beginners, rookies, amateurs, experts, pros and masters. Are there too many levels? Do we need to shave some of these off maybe?
In terms of organizing tournaments, I wouldn't be able to know because I'm not like a promoter. I'm not a tournament or director or anything like that. So I think the ratings were chosen for a reason based on the turnouts, based on the skill levels, based on, you know, so I don't know what's best for in terms of running tournaments because that also affects the number of events, the packages, the cost, everything, right? So that's aspect I don't know. In terms of the skill levels, I don't think there are too many personally because there's such a wide range of skills that skill levels, like a lot of masters will destroy pros, a lot of pros will destroy experts, a lot of experts will destroy amateurs, a lot of amateurs will destroy rookies, and rookies will destroy beginners, and so on. And of course, there are people that are underrated, which is a different story. But I think the skill gap between certain tiers is defined enough that I don't think there are too few. Like if you combined any of those ranks, you would find that there's a big gap between like the top players in that rank and the lower levels and lower players in that rank.
Right.
Whether we should have that for tournaments, I have no idea.
Ken, I'm curious with your TikTok, when you look at a defense, is there something, and you don't have to give it away, but I mean, like, is there a tell when you look at it and you're just like, oh yeah, this is a buffet and that's all you could eat, and I'm gonna have me some king crab legs.
So I don't think you will expect this answer, but like, I'm very analytical. Sure. And
I know you have notepads and stuff.
I'm probably the person that, from what I've seen, ask the most questions. Like when I lose a match, I'll ask questions about what they were thinking or how they blocked me. I'll ask, you know. So I actually created an app specifically for keeping my foosball notes, and I have extensive foosball notes. So I have actually identified, like, well, the number is ridiculous, but I have identified, like, oh my God, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I have 89 different defenses against my shot that I've asked people, and I've categorized those into multiple types of defense. Like,
wow,
you know, there'll be like standard race to the long, there'll be like bait middle, there's like a three man D, there's like a random switch, there's like a you know, like a double bait, there's a like a double race, like there's like so many different types of defenses that I've encountered and asked my opponents how they blocked me, and I've categorized them, and I have a strategy against all of those styles. There used to be styles that gave me most, so I can overcome most styles that I'm familiar with. Like if somebody gives me a race defense, I know how to overcome that. If somebody gives me like a bait and switch, if somebody like does a bait switch, I can overcome that. If somebody does a reverse, like a pure reverse, a reverse shuffle, I can overcome that. But so there's like so many different types that I have a different strategy for each one. So when they show me a defense, usually I can identify kind of what they're doing, and I have a specific strategy against that style.
All right.
Now there are some styles that give me more trouble than others that I'm still working on. And I'm kind of familiar what I need to do to actually overcome those defenses. And there are some defenses that probably I don't know what they're doing and I have to figure it out. And not everybody will tell me exactly how they blocked me, but basically I analyzed like all the different styles I could get.
Wait, so the 89 defenses you just talked about, are those based on your interpretation of what they were doing, or are they based on you asked them and they told you and then you and went in your notebook?
They're only based on what they've told me. Like, so
it's
I don't
their
like
perspective. It's not your perspective. Okay.
Yeah, so that means I've asked at least 89 people how they.
Yeah, no, I know, but I mean that's a huge difference. I mean, a lot of us sometimes look at what other people are doing and make assumptions, and then base our reactions to that, and it never works out. But you're basing
I never assume like because the times that I have assumed, I've always been wrong.
Right,
I haven't found the time that I have assumed something that was right. So,
and as Abraham Lincoln used to say, if you assume, you make an ass out of you and me. That's a direct quote. From him.
Wow.
My mind is blown by what I'm hearing. I don't know. Hannah, what the hell did you just hear? That's wild to me.
Yeah. So it's a real thing. Ken, I've had him ask me things. I've seen him ask other players things. And it's so interesting because asking plays a risk. And what if Adam beats me and then I go say, Adam, why couldn't I score on you, man? And then what if Adam just lies to me? What if he just lies? I see your trophy back there. Adam did, in fact, beat me. And I was in tears and so broken down as a person and a human being that I didn't have it in me to ask him how he beat me so badly for that event. But anyways, what if Adam beats me again and I say, Adam, what were you doing to block my pool shot, man? And he says, yeah, you know, I did A, B, C, and D. And then Adam turns around and says, hey, Tom, Hannah just asked me how I beat her. And I lied to her. And I said, I beat her doing A, B, C, and D. And in reality, I beat her doing 1, 2, 3, and 4. She has no idea. Like, and now she believes it, you know? So I run into that shooting sometimes on players, and I'll do something and then they'll block me. And then I question, did they mean to do that? Did they even know that was going to happen? Or did they get lucky? Well, we have to figure that part out, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another aspect that comes into Ken asking, you know, how did you block me? You know, that truth and then their perception. You know, say Ken was perceiving it properly and had the right idea and they accidentally ran into it. But they thought they did something great because the result worked in their favor when it's kind of like guessing on a test and getting it right and then thinking you did great on the test and now you need to go do surgery on somebody because you just guessed right on all these answers and you don't know anything about surgery. You know, it's like, yeah, it worked out short term, but long term it doesn't. So that's an interesting idea and an interesting way to do things, because I agree, you can't always assume. I mean, you make the wrong assumption, then you're just kind of shooting yourself in the foot anyways. So, yeah, I know you do that though. And I know clearly you want to learn about the game. I feel like it comes from a good place. And I feel like you're one that is willing to help others to do that as well. Because I think you're just intrigued by foosball. So I think that's really, really cool. That's a different strategy than most take to the game. Yeah. I feel
the best time to ask somebody for tips is when they just destroyed you, because they don't see you as a threat, and they kind of feel sorry for you in a way. So they'll tell you things. Some of my best knowledge comes from those matches where I was absolutely annihilated.
Sure. So,
and usually I can tell when people are lying or not telling the whole truth. Like, I'll ask questions and they'll tell me something, and I know enough about, you know, what they're talking about to feel like, I know that's not the whole story, but it's okay if you don't want to tell me. You know, I'll tell them that.
Right.
And then a few times, you know, I catch people lying. You know, like a top player one time told me something about what they did in a certain rod or during a timeout or something. And I could feel something was fishy or didn't feel right. So I actually came back later and asked his partner what they discussed. And basically he told me something that was pretty much opposite to what he said. So I knew something was off. You know? So sometimes they'll tell me something, and if it does not make sense from a player perspective, I can usually tell, like, they're not telling me the truth. But sometimes it does make sense. Like, for example, sometimes people have told me my tell, you know, like they'll break me and they'll say, like, this was your tell. And I was reading this. And then I'll look at my game and I was like, yeah, they were right. They were reading that. So those are very valuable. And I feel like it speeds up my learning process, because maybe I wouldn't have detected that. Some people have tells that they'll never fix for their whole lives.
It's so true.
One time a guy was like blown away. He told me, like, because I told him something, and he was like, you just won me worlds, you know, because I told him something that we actually traded. Like, he told me something and I told him something about his game, and he was like, nobody's ever told me that, and that's the reason I lost this and this and this match, you know, because I didn't know my game. So
yeah, that's a big side of foosball, like the social aspect. You know, you said, like, you know, like, I see this guy as an actual person now, and like we have a connection. But like, this is played out, and it's lame, but I'm gonna say it. When I came into foosball, I didn't care about anybody but myself. I was selfish. I wanted to win, and I didn't care about anybody there besides like two people, and those are my only two friends. I didn't spend time talking to other people because I didn't care. Well, when I came back to foosball, I kind of shifted that, and I wanted to meet people that were different. I held more conversations with people. I went out of my way to make a social effort, say. And it plays out and it works better in the long run if you're just nicer to people. Mm-hmm. So in Vegas, say, perfect example, when someone gives you some information about yourself or about your foosball game, and it's about a tell per se, it's like a revelation. You're just like, wow, I have been doing that my whole life, and you were so accurate. And you just feel like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe this. You know, it just really makes you like, man, I want to go wash my hands. But yeah, someone told me something about my game at that weekend, and it was like, wow. And every time I didn't do it, I scored. And even on people that I usually have a lot of trouble scoring on. And I was like, wow, interesting. Thanks for that. And I also had some of those people that I was nice to for no reason come up to me and say, hey, you're about to play Billy and Bobby. Well, come here. Let me tell you something about his shot. When he does this, it's always going to be this. And it won me several matches that past weekend. And I took him, wrote him down on my phone. Never going to forget it. But it does help, because if I wouldn't have spoken to those people, they would have never cared enough about me to help me to win that next match, and or to tell me about myself, you know? So I think that's a big part of foosball, and it's often overlooked. But I think you can learn from it. I truly believe that. I mean, it's very clear to me after Vegas. Sure.
It pays off to be nice in life, I would say.
Doesn't it?
Good policy. That's good policy advice. A quick question for you, Ken. Are you a good chess player?
I don't know enough about chess to consider myself a good chess player. So I would say no.
Okay.
Could I be good at chess if I really studied? Maybe, but I'm not. I played chess against a foosball player one time, and he said, "Ken, you're so funny because you take like so long to make a move, and then it's the stupidest move."
Who'd you play, Arthur?
Oh my god, it wasn't him, but he was a decent chess player, but not Arthur. Arthur would have been probably even more humiliating. But no, I don't consider myself good at chess.
Well, you sound like you could be a good student of that game because of the way you look at foosball. You're very very calculating, and of course. 89 different defenses you have written down. That's that's very chess-like, for sure.
yeah.
We got a chat here. Ahead. Sorry. And wait, Hannah, did you?
I was going to do the same thing.
Okay,
take over. Your voice is better.
You do it. I'm like, good evening, folks. I know. I'm practicing in the car. Bill Chance says, hey, Ken. What do you feel is your strongest bar?
Ooh.
Hi, Bill, because Bill's a great guy. He's my friend, and you know, he's a great guy. Offensively or defensively would be my question, because
Go one and then the other.
Okay, so the strongest part of my game, in my opinion, is my goalie defense, in my opinion. So that would be my strongest in general. And ironically, actually, and then the strongest part offensively would be my 2-5. Because it's so effective, basically.
So your tic-tac doesn't even figure into that.
I would say my tic-tac is very strong, especially against people who haven't studied my game. I feel like people who studied my game tend to have much better defense against me. I can tell the difference. Like, some people block me really, really well, and some people, oh my god. But my 2-5 works almost against everybody, almost universally. There might be some people that maybe steal a few balls, but I'm extremely comfortable on my 2-5. And my shot, I'm comfortable, but not against everybody. My shot, I'm super comfortable against most lower rated players. It's like really easy generally. The higher level players are more familiar with my game, especially if I play them often. So it's not as easy nowadays against some players that I play often. So, but my 2-5, I've always like, I usually never had issues with it. So. Mm-hmm.
And I agree, because the last time I played you in singles, I think, was pro singles for fifth or something. It was decent. And I hadn't played you in singles in like a really long time. I don't know if I'd ever played you in singles, honestly. And yeah, cool. Got some blocks on your three. Great. You blocked me exceptionally well. Hence the I'm really good at defensive thing you were talking about. Yeah, touche. But the game changer was the 2-5. You know, you do it in an area of the table that's a decision area. So you have to decide, you know, which guide you're coming to get or, you know, whatever. And I was just getting into that, but that made me go and figure out, you know, okay, it's in a decision area. You have to decide if you run this way, he's going to get the ball every time because you can't physically run all the way back down to block it that way. But yeah, you read that really well. And as a first time player seeing that happen, it was like, wow, I'm getting destroyed. You know what I mean? So like, I do believe that that's the type of game you have to go back and kind of think through. And I can see why you have a lot of success with that. And you've studied it. You know, most people like switch to a 2-5 early on into that series. They rely on like noise, like bounce, 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 second man, or bounce, 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 brush up. And it's like so fast and not calculated that they just rely on like bounce, 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 go. And it's not a decision. So, but you could tell yours is very thought out. There's a process to it, and you're making a decision and then executing. You know, I think that's the in yours and several others on tour are people that just generally switch over to a 2-5 for a few possessions through the game, because there are several people that, you know, they shoot the ball, but if stuff gets tight, they're like, oh yeah, let me go do a 2-5. And it's not as well thought usually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and part of it is people are not very good at defending that style in particular, I feel.
Oh, yeah. I agree for sure.
I can execute good enough, and I can read the hole good enough. It's just vast majority of people give me a defense that is relatively very easy to read for me.
Did you learn that on your own, or how did you structure creating a 2-5 series?
One of the reasons because I watched Colin Young when I was starting out, and he did some form of 2-5. I developed it based on, I didn't copy him, but I developed a 2-5 as well. Tony did a 2-5, but it was a bit different. But the reason I do it that way is because in Germany, it wasn't allowed to bounce the ball three times off the wall. So I didn't bounce it. And that's the main reason I don't bounce the ball off the wall, is because I originally learned on the P4P table when I went to Germany in college. So I couldn't bounce it. So that's the reason I don't bounce it off the wall. But the reason I played with a 2-5 is because probably my two favorite players, Colin Young and Tony, did a 2-5. So I copied that, the concept. Yeah.
Have you heard of the idea that some people feel that they should make the 2-5 illegal? How do you feel about that? And what would you do if that were taken away?
I think for me, the less time I spend thinking about what other people say, the better for my game. But In terms of that opinion, I'm indifferent to it. Like, if they think that way, I'm not really reactive to that. I mean, everybody has their opinion. If they did make the 2-5 illegal, I would adjust, because at the end of the day, I like foosball, and I will, you know, if they make something illegal, I'll just switch to a different thing. Whatever, like maybe I'll do a 2-3 instead. And if they make that illegal, maybe I'll shoot, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I would adjust, basically.
As any good foosball player would do, just adjust.
Yeah. Well, some people quit when their favorite stuff, or, you know, even when they're forced to go to a different table. I know back home, we didn't have tornadoes. We played on a Peruvian table, which was extremely different than, you know, probably anything that people have played on. So when we started playing on, you know, fireball, we started playing on fireballs first. A lot of people quit because they couldn't handle the change. So some people adapt. Some people just quit. They don't like the change, you know? And I'm sure that happened with a lot of players that played in the old days, you know, maybe the style changed and they
quit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people quit, some people adapt, and some people quit and look back and bitch about how everything was better back then.
Yeah,
and they give you it's
worth it to the effort to change your whole game, you know?
Sure.
You mean actually try? Yeah. I think that's hard. Yeah. I think that's a really good point. Like, you know, a lot of people just aren't willing to do that, so it's easier to kind of complain.
Yeah, if they spend 20,000 hours mastering a certain move and all of a sudden it's banned, do they really want to spend another 20,000 hours on whatever else they're going to do now? You know, yeah.
There's sympathy for that. So what's on your slate for the rest of the year? You said that Texas State is kind of a maybe for you, or
maybe it's a maybe. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, but after that though, what are you doing here in the U.S. anyways?
Maybe nationals. I'm not sure the details of that either, and probably all of the IFP tournaments as well for the rest of the year. I'm actually flying back to Peru tonight,
or 5
a.m. actually.
Really?
Yeah. After 4 months, I've been touring for 4 months. Well, since the TKO, maybe 4.5. I don't know.
Wow.
It's been a long foosball trip, so I'm gonna go back. Since I haven't been back since January, but I'll come back soon. I'll probably be back home for a month or so, and then I'll come back.
So Worlds, obviously, you're gonna do. And what about like Bardo or any of those other things? Do you hit those up? Or
so when they're not IFP tournaments, it depends. Like I went to Florida, on my own. I didn't do the setup and teardown there. It's all about fitting it in my logistics schedule, whether it's on the way to some other tournament I'm going to, whether I can pay the airfare, which it depends on how much cash I have, because I use my winnings to fund my own foosball dream. So so depending on whether I can fit it in my tour stops, then I'll try to make it. I made Colorado last year. It was a very expensive trip. Fortunately, I ended up being in the positives in the end. I got kind of scared for a while. You know, it was an expensive trip for me, but it worked out. So it all depends on the logistics and the budget, really, when it's not IFP. I try to make as many as I can, though.
So how do you feel about the trend that's been happening within the last couple of years here, including Tornado Worlds, Hall of Fame Classic? We've seen a lot more international players making the top of the leaderboards. How's that feel for you? And what do you think about what do you think Americans need to do to get their dominance back?
I think you're seeing people from Europe like perform well, but I haven't seen them like challenge Tony on Tornado, for example, or like win open singles.
Right.
So I guess when you mean for all of the rest of us that are not like the top masters, they don't really have to think about the European. I think people just have to keep improving their own game.
Sure.
And then because everybody else might be improving, like the Europeans that come over to the States, they're also practicing and getting better. So as long as they're also practicing and getting better, I'm sure it might be a different style, but then again, the Europeans also are not as familiar with the American style. So, and I think it speaks to, Europeans trying out the Tornado more and liking it more and wanting to play good on the table, which is a great thing. It's always nice to have like a different style to play somebody on Tornado that has a different style of play, because you learn more, you know, the more styles that you face against, the more well-rounded you can be as a player. So,
sure.
So I think it's great that they're coming. It's great for them. It's great for the people here in the States.
Great for the sport.
It is great. You know,
More diversity,
and it makes everything more challenging, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's exciting to see that. And
Now,
one of the things that we always kind of bat around as a thought is that, you know, for years the World Cup has been held just in Europe. I mean, Europe is great when it comes to foosball. It's very ingrained in the culture. But don't you think that maybe on occasion we ought to take a World Cup, sort of like the Olympics, and hold it in different countries outside of Europe?
Yeah, it's all about, I think, I mean, I don't know all the intricacies, but I do think it's very complicated to organize such a big event.
Right.
So it's not about, so I think there's not a lot of people fighting to organize the World Cup based on how expensive it is and so complicated. You know, it might be like a big headache to, like, I can't imagine, it has to be a huge headache.
Oh, logistically, like, yeah. Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, like that's a big one, and there's a lot that's done to promote it, and, you know, advertisements and even sponsorships or whatever it may be. It seems like such a big event that I don't see many countries out there that are even able to organize such a big thing.
Right.
Even in the States, I mean, it would cost a lot of money to actually not only have the tornado tables but have all these other tables as well. And transporting them from Europe, like, it sounds like a huge headache for anybody who has to organize it. So I'm not sure if people are really fighting to be the organizers.
Yeah. No, they're not.
I think the ITSF would gladly have it in another country if there were other countries like actively bidding and having a serious bid for those.
And you're absolutely right, Ken. Like, if there was money involved and you could do that here and make money off of it, but you still have to ship 5, 6 whatever tables out here, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's not cost effective. And, you know, if you've got a bunch of money, you want to put money into it, fine. But that's just not happening.
And it's qualifiers too. So it's not like people are paying entry fees that can actually help fund that either.
That being said, I would love to see a World Cup in Vegas or something like that. That would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
It would be awesome.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. I would love for more people here in America to actually experience what it's like to play in world, to actually be, I mean, not everybody will be able to qualify.
Right.
That's true. But, but it's a different type of experience.
Yeah.
So I really feel like I'm fortunate that I was able to experience that.
Yeah. I wish that as fans, I think it would be awesome for Americans to go do that. But anyways, Ken, I really appreciate chatting with you here this evening, and I think we're going to be wrapping up here. But before we get to you and last words, I'd like to just go around the horn here. And Tom, any last thoughts, words, questions, comments, et ceteras?
Yeah, not to go into great detail, but I'm curious, where would you like to be in your career as a foosball player in 5 years? Mm.
Well, I want to be the best in the world. You know, I want to win the world championships, open singles at least. I want to win the ITSF world singles championships.
Nice.
It'd be nice to be number one ranking in ITSF as well for a year at least.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I see it.
That's awesome, man. Good luck to that. I with your kind of dedication to the sport, it sounds like that's well within your grasp.
I will tell. I believe it. So that's why I'm still going.
Nice. Hannah.
Ken, I think a lot of you, I'm happy for you that you're getting to tour and you have this opportunity, you know, to live this foosball dream. And I think you're taking advantage of it. I think your game has progressed a lot since you've been on the tour. And it's well-deserved. You know, you're going to all the tour stops. I tell my friends, you know, I learn something new at every tour stop, every single one. If you're not learning something at a different tour stop, you're not trying hard enough. And that just amplifies, you know, how many you get to go to. So I know you have the right mindset going into that. And happy for you. Congrats on all your wins. I don't care if you win 32 more pro singles. I'm still in your corner rooting for you. I think it's well-deserved. Yeah, it's well-deserved. Nothing but good stuff for you, buddy.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate you.
Of course.
Always a joy interacting with you in the tournaments.
Ken, before I give the floor over to you for any last words, you're an actor. And I'm just curious.
Well, I'm an actor.
You're an actor. So what is the what did you
well,
say?
Okay, well that's not okay, so I do more than one thing. Like, so before I did foosball, yeah, I did some acting in Peru. That's not the only thing I did. I also I'm actually a computer science major guy. So I do AI and stuff like that. So I do a lot of random stuff, but I did do some acting for a few years in Peru. I wasn't like a superstar or anything, but I did some commercials, some TV series and stuff like.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I get it. You have your actor thing that you can do and the voice and all that. Do you know Mary Had a Little Lamb? Do you know that? Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Can you do Mary Had a Little Lamb, Fleece as White as Snow, but in your actor thing?
Oh no, I don't know. Oh no, no, no. Actually, the way that I did act, I was actually pretty shy about acting. Actually, I did acting because I used to be pretty shy. So it was one of the ways I did to actually break out of my shell. So I'm actually shy about acting. So when I did act, I got the script like in advance and I rehearsed it a lot before doing it. So when people told me, can you act, like, go ahead? And I'm like, no, there's no way. Like, no.
You can't act in advance.
Act.
And on video as well. It's like even worse. I would have to rehearse it a little bit.
I love that. That's very honest.
I would have to be like forced into it. Like 1, 2, 3, like the scene is go, you know.
Ken.
Okay. I've got one more comment.
Yeah, go ahead. Yep.
One more comment here for me. We were all sitting around and at Colorado State, I think. And it was like me and the clowns and Ken. It was like me and Isabel and Bracklin and like Evan McGregor and Jacob Balco. It was like all the clown crew. And then Ken walks down and like sits in a chair and like we're hanging out. I was like, what's up, Ken? I'm like, what's up? And like Evan's got his guitar and he's like, yeah, man, I'm really nervous because I'm supposed to go and play, you know, the Star Spangled Banner at this little thing they're going to have. And we ended up missing the whole ceremony and he didn't do it. But anyway, he's like, can somebody sing? Because I really need someone to sing for me to play the guitar. And like out of nowhere, Ken's like, yeah, I got y'all. Let's go play it. And then he starts playing it. And then Ken's just like bawling, singing, like no pressure, no stress, just like crushing the Star Spangled Banner with us clowns, like boom. And Bracklin was like, yeah, someone like that. When you're like, hey, can someone sing? And they just like jump in and they're like, I got it. What's up? They're like 9 out of 9 times. They're always great. And I was like, well, so yeah, Ken can sing you the Star Spangled Banner, dude, if you need it.
Dude, wait. And before you say anything, Ken, the Star Spangled, I'm a musician. I know music. I teach music. The Star Spangled Banner is an incredibly difficult song to sing and learn because it's the octave shifts are just ridiculous. It's all over the place. And you peeled that off right there in front of everybody.
Crushed it.
Crushed it.
Okay, well.
Give us an OC, well, guess, can you see? Just come on. You don't have to. You don't have to. Don't do it. Don't do
the
it.
The thing is, I can be so spontaneous sometimes, but this is on video. What if I don't crush it and it's on video forever?
Oh, like, I can edit all this.
Maybe if I was right in front of you, I would.
All right. That's fair.
Well, I have a confession. I have it on video. Right
and,
here.
And now Hannah says,
put it up to your mic.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Come on. I'm going to hear it. Let's hear it. Yeah. Just play it. Here.
No, I'm not. No.
It's not. Is it bad?
It's Patreons only.
Oh, okay.
Patreons only. That's right, Hannah.
That's nice. All right. I like that.
You got to pay for that content.
By the way, Hannah, thank you so much because you just wrote one of the scenes from the upcoming movie about foosball and hidden gems like Ken Dale.
Yeah. So the Kenneth Dale story. I love it.
Yep, there it is. And that scene is going to appear in the movie right there.
Well,
and they're all going to start dancing.
Oh, damn, Tom. Calm down, bro. I love that. All right. Yeah.
Maybe one of these days I might do it, but I have to be mentally prepared for it.
You don't have to be mentally prepared to be in the moment.
So it's like
you know,
I don't just want to.
And just to throw this out there, because I often wonder this, Ken, and you take notes, but I think that I see Brandon Munoz and Blake Robertson and Tony Spreideman and those, I think you would say the master level, they often do things that I don't think they're actually like thinking about doing, right?
Yeah.
Like, is it not about just doing something in the moment? Is that not what that next level is?
It is totally about that, but... Yeah.
Isn't it not more just being okay with just laying your soul bare out there for everybody to see in case you do fuck up?
You know what makes it worse is that I am a bit rusty. I haven't acted like in a long time. Like,
no, I just want you to sing the Star Spangled Banner. Just give an Osei KFC.
I think I'm rusty with the singing too, and I was actually I was just doing it as a joke, like with Anna. I didn't even think it was any good, but
sounds like it was good. Anna thinks it was good.
It was solid for sure.
Yeah,
Ken, I just want to bring you up to speed when it comes to acting. You have when you have a director like Adam yelling at you, you just turn around and say, "Dude, what's my motivation?" Right? What's my motivation?
My answer is always cheese, charcuterie, whatever. All right. Anyways, you know. So we've.
Chatted. I wish I could have treated you to some nice acting or whatever.
You don't have to do any acting.
You're good.
Yeah, or singing. Yeah, or singing.
Next time.
We don't have to wish for it. You could just do it.
No. Oh my God, no.
Adam, you're just brutal.
I'm too rusty, I think. To do it on camera, I think I'm too rusty.
Well, anyway, so we've all had our last words, and you know, the floor for you, the floor is yours, Ken. And any last words or anything else you want to say to anybody else out there as we wrap up here? And we thank you for being here tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I think it's really cool that you do this and, you know, give the spotlight to players and, you know, give the opportunity for people to watch and listen. And I think that's extremely cool. So shout out to you guys for doing this. And of course, what can I say? I want to thank everybody that really helps me every time I come here to the States. Like literally, I could do nothing without all the people that are helping me. I would rather not say the names right now because there's so many people that I know I will miss names, and I don't want to do that. But maybe if I write them down, like on a sheet of paper, I can read them all. But there's a lot of people, you know, people that I stay with, people that give me rides to places, you know, or even people that, you know, offer a drink. Here's, you know, or tips or whatever it is. None of this is possible with all the people that help me. So, you know, I think the foosball community as a whole is pretty giving because we share this passion. So thank you to all of you. And, I hope I can give that back to you someday.
Thank you, Ken.
Cool.
Thank you, Hannah.
Pretty much it.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you everybody out there for listening. We appreciate that. Bill Chance, appreciate you being here and everybody else that was listening on Twitch. We will see you next time.